13.
Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
Fr.
Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, SJ.
Has been a respected teacher for the proponents of the United Religions Initiative and of the New Age movement. Barbara Marx Hubbard described Teilhard de Chardin as a spiritual godfather of conscious evolution. One, Matthew Fox drew upon Teilhard de Chardin when writing about the cosmic Christ. Two, in an essay titled, My Five Teilhardian Enlightenments, Robert Mueller said, much of what I have observed in the world bears out the all-encompassing, global, forward-looking philosophy of Teilhard de Chardin. Three, theosophist David Spangler said that the life and writings of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin are a splendid example of revelation and consistent with the general release to the lay public of the mystery teachings through such avenues as the Theosophical Society, the Anthroposophical Society, New Thought Movements, and others. For Father Daniel Martin, who was the coordinator of the UN's Environmental Sabbath Program, said in 1990, the notion of the earth being somehow alive is helping. It harkens back to the French philosopher Teilhard de Chardin and subsequently Thomas Berry's thinking that the whole process of cosmogenesis is a spiritual act. It's the manifestation of the Creator. If you want to put it in a mystical way, we're talking about the birth of God. 5A group of Teilhard's followers in the Netherlands, the Foundation Teilhard de Chardin in the Netherlands, lists the URI as one of its allied organizations. 6. Ursula King, a founder of the Teilhard Center in London, said, Teilhard always sided with the modernists and progressives of any religion, never with the traditionalists. It was a neo-Christianity, but also a neo-Buddhism and a neo-Hinduism and other reform movements that took the modern world seriously, that in his view could perhaps show us to a spiritually helpful and enriching way forward. 7. Therefore, Teilhard's views on theology and politics provide background and context for the present-day worldview and agenda of the URI and its New Age, globalist allies. Teilhard's message was consistent over the years. What he said to friends in private letters clarified his more general comments in his essays and addresses. It should be noted that, however offbeat much of Teilhard's theology was, he remained Christian and loyal to the Catholic Church. In 1951, he wrote to his superior, the general of the Jesuits in Rome, that I now feel more indissolubly bound to the hierarchical church and to the Christ of the gospel than ever before in my life. Never has Christ seemed to me more real, more personal, and more immense. One, in a journal entry made within a week of his death in 1955, Teilhard said that Christ is the most sustaining and only redeeming force. 2. Despite the resemblances, noted below, between his writings and those of the theosophists, Teilhard was not a theosophist himself. In 1932, he said that the current revival of theosophy and neo-Buddhism in the West appears to be founded upon a vast misunderstanding. In strict logic, the Indian sage cannot concern himself with anything the life of the world has been, is, or will be. His European followers, I fear, are a long way from realizing this. 3. Teilhard wrote in 1934 that he aimed at a general convergence of religions upon a universal Christ who fundamentally satisfies them all. That seems to me the only possible conversion of the world, and the only form in which a religion of the future can be conceived. For he viewed theosophy as world-denying and wished instead to affirm the divinely oriented evolution of the world. Teilhard saw no contradiction between faith in God and faith in human and terrestrial evolution. He said, the supernaturalizing Christian above is incorporated, not immersed, in the human ahead. And at the same time, faith in God, in the very degree in which it assimilates and sublimates within its own spirit the spirit of faith in the world, regains all its power to convert the emerging common soul of humanity. Foreshadowing Bishop Swing's chatter about the emergence of a global soul, 6. Teilhard de Chardin said in 1937, under the combined effect of the material needs and spiritual affinities of life, humanity all around us is beginning to emerge from impersonality and assume some sort of heart and face. With the recording of this mysterious birth, the most general picture so far vouchsafed us of the biological current that is drawing us on is completed and disappears from sight. The organization of human energy, taken as a whole, is directed and pushes us towards the ultimate formation, over and above each personal element, of a common soul of humanity. 7. Did you know that you are a personal element? In March 1945, Teilhard said, for men upon earth, all the earth, to learn to love one another. It is not enough that they should know themselves to be members of one and the same thing. In planetizing themselves, they must acquire the consciousness, without losing themselves, of becoming one and the same person. One, this insistence that people merge their separated personhood into the one was recently restated by Neil Donald Walsh's spirit guide, who said, "The highest choice for the self becomes the highest choice for another when the self realizes that there is no one else, too, and that you must stop seeing God as separate from you, and you as separate from each other. The only solution is the ultimate truth. Nothing exists in the universe that is separate from anything else." The bleak eschatology of the Omega Point. Although there is no evidence that Teilhard de Chardin was aware of, let alone a follower of, Alice Bailey, he appeared to share her view that death could be a liberation from material existence. In Human Energy, he asked in 1931, "How will the spiritual evolution of our planet end?" We asked at the conclusion of the preceding chapter. Perhaps, we will now reply, in a psychic rather than material turning point, possibly like a death, which will in fact be a liberation from the material plane of history and elevation in God. For Teilhard proposed in 1945 in The Future of Man that, is it not conceivable that mankind, at the end of its totalization, its folding in upon itself, may reach a critical level of maturity where, leaving the earth and stars to lapse slowly back into the dwindling mass of primordial energy, it will detach itself from this planet and join the one true, irreversible essence of things, the Omega Point? A phenomenon perhaps outwardly akin to death, but in reality a simple metamorphosis and arrival at the supreme synthesis. In any event, of all the theories which we may evolve concerning the end of the earth, it is the only one which affords a coherent prospect wherein, in the remote future, the deepest and most powerful currents of human consciousness may converge and culminate. Intelligence and action, learning and religion. 5. Teilhard has a reputation as an evolutionary optimist, but his eschatological vision is far bleaker than the biblical promise of a new heaven and a new earth, in which the dwelling of God is with men, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Revelation 21 verses 1 and 3, 4. Faith in progress. Teilhard sometimes wrote as an ardent believer in human progress, and sometimes as one who looked beyond such temporal goals to Christ. Teilhard wrote in 1941, "I am convinced that finally it is upon the idea of progress and faith in progress that mankind, today so divided, must rely and can reshape itself." 6. In 1947 he said, "Let us not forget that faith in peace is not possible, not justifiable, except in a world dominated by faith in the future, faith in man and the progress of man." 7. Teilhard explained his zeal in a letter to a friend that year. "The Christian faith can recover and survive only by incorporating faith in human progress. And it is also my conviction that if this synthesis between faith in God and faith in man were put into effect, we would again see, and in much more universal and intense form, what has happened a few times in history, for example with Buddhism, Christianity, and Marxism. I mean the spreading like wildfire of a new state of mind. Is it not this climate and this new atmosphere that are necessary if our incredible technological resources are to succeed in producing their natural result of human unification?" 1. Nevertheless, in 1947, he told the French section of the World Congress of Faiths, correctly interpreted, I repeat, "Faith in man can and indeed must cast us at the feet and into the arms of one who is greater than ourselves." 2. Teilhard warned that the idea of man, self-sufficient and wholly autonomous, was the modern version of the heroic temptation of all time, that of the Titans, of Prometheus, of Babel and of Faust, that of Christ on the mountain, apologetic for totalitarianism. In his writings before, during, and after World War II, Teilhard explicitly and repeatedly favored totalitarianism. He was able to discern contributions to human evolution from the tyrants of his time, and did so in his public essays and in his private letters to friends. Teilhard said in 1937 in Human Energy, "The future economy must be international and in the end totalitarian." Seemingly, no less urgent than the question of sources of energy is the worldwide installation of a general economy of production and labor, reinforced by the establishment of a rational gold policy. Financial and social crises are at pains to remind us how confused our theories are in these matters and how barbarous our conduct. But when will men decide to recognize that no serious progress can be made in these directions except under two conditions? First, that the proposed organization must be international and in the end totalitarian. Four, and secondly, that it must be conceived on a very large scale. 5. In March 1939, Teilhard wrote that the time for egotistical autonomy had passed. The individual, if he is to fulfill and preserve himself, must strive to break down every kind of barrier that prevents separate beings from uniting. His is the exaltation, not of egotistical autonomy, but of communion with all others. Seen in this light, the modern totalitarian regimes, whatever their initial defects, are neither heresies nor biological regressions. They are in line with the essential trend of cosmic movement. 6. Furthermore, in the totalitarian political systems, of which time will correct the excesses but will also, no doubt, accentuate the underlying tendencies or intuitions, the citizen finds his center of gravity gradually transferred to, or at least aligned with, that of the national or ethnic group to which he belongs. This is not a return to primitive and undifferentiated cultural forms, but the emergence of a defined social system in which a purposeful organization orders the masses and tends to impose a specialized function on each individual. Teilhard concluded, "So there is no way out, if we wish to safeguard the preeminence of the spirit, except by taking the one road that remains to us, which leads to the preservation and further advance of consciousness, the road of unification. A convergent world, whatever sacrifice of freedom it may seem to demand of us, is the only one which can preserve the dignity and the aspirations of the living being. Therefore, it must be true. If we are to avoid total anarchy, the source and the sign of universal death, we can do no other than plunge resolutely forward, even though something in us perish, into the melting pot of socialization." 1. Teilhard expressed his boredom with the Allied cause in World War II in December 1939. "And still I cannot yet be really excited by this war. I realize its urgency, and its drama, and even the great object it is to repel the reign of material force. But I have an obscure feeling that the Allies are fighting too much for quietness and stability, or rather immobility. And this point becomes always clearer in myself. The only fight in which I would like to mix and to die should be a battle for construction and movement ahead. I still hope that some agreement may be reached without any major clash. Whatever should be the end, the world needs a thorough readjustment under a more definite human common ideal." 2. Within days of the French collapse in 1940, Teilhard wrote, "Since the beginning, I did not like this war. Because I felt, maybe I told you, that, on the Allies' side, there was not any spirit of conquest and renovation. Only fighting to keep going on an old-fashioned, bourgeois, sick, conception of man. There is something dreadfully primitive and narrow in the Hitler's sick religion and ideal. But the Germans had an internal flame, and this was too strong for us, much more than the tanks." 3. In August 1940, Teilhard wrote to a friend that the Germans deserve to win the war. "Personally, I stick to my idea that we are watching the birth, more than the death, of a world. But the scandal, as you pointed exactly, is that England and France should have come to this tragedy because they have sincerely tried the road of peace. But did they not precisely make a mistake on the true meaning of peace? Peace cannot mean anything but a higher process of conquest. And, since 1919, France at least did scarcely more than to stick comfortably to the old routines. World is bound to belong to its most active elements. If we are defeated today by sheer brutal force, the reason is, I believe, that we did not, after the last war, find a spiritual and constructive outlet for force. Just now, the Germans deserve to win because, however bad or mixed is their spirit, they have more spirit than the rest of the world. It is easy to criticize and despise the fifth column, but no spiritual aim or energy will ever succeed, or even deserve to succeed, unless it proves able to spread and to keep spreading a fifth column. To incorporate spirit in force, or either to sublimate force into spirit. This is the problem, and this ought to be our dream. In fact, I am even unable to understand what did really happen in June, and what this funny Pétain government really means." 4. Teilhard's desire to unite spirit and force calls to mind Daniel's prophecy concerning an eschatological tyrant. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Dan 11:38, KJV. Later that same month, Teilhard said, Peitan government is full of goodwill, but I am afraid it has no spark, and the reforms it promotes have no clean roots in the country. The great present crisis obliges everybody to face the major problem of constructing the world as a whole. Provided we escape the temptation to take refuge in the old shelters, nothing better could happen to drive us ahead. In September 1940, Teilhard wrote, "Of one thing I am certain, that you are reacting with all your strength to the defeat and are trying to find a way that will lead to a renaissance that will not be a bourgeois restoration. From this distance, it is the specter of such a restoration that most disturbs me. Vichy's copybook maxims for good children seem to be entirely to lack the fire which alone can bring about the virtues so rightly advocated." One, what virtues did the collaborationist government advocate, and why would Teilhard have found bourgeois restoration more disturbing than the occupation of his country by the Nazis? However, in October 1940, Teilhard wrote that it was especially painful for me to swallow some of Vichy's attitudes. "The more I have always been since 1920 an advocate of a friendly understanding with Germany, the more repugnant to me now is a forced understanding which would entail a sort of betrayal of our real friends in the Anglo-Saxon circles." 2. In February 1941, Teilhard wrote to a friend, "My leading idea, just now, is that the true crisis of the world, today, does not lie exactly in a conflict between totalitarians and democrats, but between mobilists and fixists. If the democracies were not hampered by the heavy load of fixism which hides and excuses, glorifies itself among them, under the usurped name of liberty, they would swallow in no time the powers of the Axis, or at least they would soon find a ground for mutual achievement. A progressive democrat is not fundamentally different from a really progressive totalitarian. Consequently, the main thing today, on the field of sound propaganda, is to make a campaign for the faith, a passionate and rational faith, in a well-understood human progress." 3. At the end of the letter, he added, "I envy the Britons. Not only do they save themselves, but, since Dunkirk, it would seem that they have stolen from the Nazis the moral leadership of the world. For, what manner of theologian would concede, even in the past tense, that the Nazis had ever had the moral leadership of the world that could be stolen from them?" In March 1941, Teilhard wrote, "I am convinced that the present war is, at bottom, a conflict between mobilists and immobilists, and that it will stop the minute the mobilists, in each camp, will recognize each other and drop the political and religious immobilists." 5. He added that he was greatly pleased by the booklet of and Lindbergh, The Wave of the Future. 6. In that pamphlet, Lindbergh had written, "I cannot see this war, then, simply and purely, as a struggle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. If I could simplify it into a phrase at all, it would seem truer to say that the forces of the past are fighting against the forces of the future. The tragedy is, to the honest spectator, that there is so much that is good in the forces of the past, and so much that is evil in the forces of the future." 7. Teilhard had said the same in December 1940. "I strongly believe within Lindbergh that this present war is only scum on the wave of the future." 8. Note the timing. The Jesuit theologian and the American writer perceived ambiguity in World War II at the time that the Nazis and the Soviets were still allies, and when Hitler was at the peak of his power in Europe. In August 1941, Teilhard wrote, "A profound source of personal irritation is my inability to take sides in the conflict. Fundamentally, the only thing I believe in, the only thing I have chosen, is that one must believe in a future of the earth which will coincide with the totalization of humanity. My enemies are those who deny progress. And this, by the way, is why since September 1939 I have not cared for this war which, from the French point of view, was merely a defense of egoism and the status quo. The constructive idealism, however distorted, was on the other side. For the last year, fortunately, things have been changing, and the democracies are beginning to understand that freedom is a thing that is won by means of organized effort. But the separation of the elements is far from complete. No one will ever dissuade me from thinking that the real divide, the real human conflict of today, is not between Democrats, fascists, communists, and Christians, but between those who do and do not believe that there is a humanity to be constructed over and above man, to save and complete man, to be precise. It is a struggle between stability and movement. Concerning the Vichy regime, he added, I have no taste for a pan-European serfdom that would lead us straight to the anthill, which it is biologically necessary to avoid. It seems that in the shadow of Vichy, a sincere effort at reconstruction is underway, which is not simply a reaction, that would be the end of everything. Granting this, it seems evident from a distance that honor is lost on that side. And I have no confidence in reforms, however timely, that are built on a foundation of cowardice. Where are our fathers of 89? Actually, I feel as if for the moment I no longer have a country. But there is still the Earth Point 2 in March 1945, Teilhard said, I do not think we are yet in a position to judge recent totalitarian experiments fairly. That is to say, to decide whether, all things considered, they have produced a greater degree of enslavement or a higher level of spiritual energy. It is too early to say. But I believe this can be said, that in so far as these first attempts may seem to be tending dangerously towards the subhuman state of the anthill or the termitary, it is not the principle of totalization that is at fault, but the clumsy and incomplete way in which it has been applied. Point 3 In December 1945, Teilhard proposed surrender to inevitable historic trends. Although our individualistic instincts may rebel against this drive towards the collective, they do so in vain and wrongly. In vain, because no power in the world can enable us to escape from what is in itself the power of the world. And wrongly, because the real nature of this impulse that is sweeping us toward a state of superorganization is such as to make us more completely personalized and human. The very fact of us becoming aware of this profound ordering of things will enable human collectivization to pass beyond the enforced phase, where it now is, into the free phase. That in which, men having at last understood that they are inseparably joined elements of a converging whole, and having learnt in consequence to love the preordained forces that unite them, a natural union of affinity and sympathy will supersede the forces of compulsion. Point 4 At the end, such was the fate of Winston, the central character of 1984. He had won the victory over himself. He loved Big Brother. 5 In 1947, Teilhard predicted a convergence between Christianity and Marxism, equating the faith of the Stalinists to that of the Christians. Take the two extremes confronting us at this moment, the Marxist and the Christian, each a convinced believer in his own particular doctrine, but each, we must suppose, fundamentally inspired with an equal faith in man. The divergence between them is in reality neither complete nor final. Followed to their conclusion, the two paths must certainly end by coming together. For in the nature of things, everything that is faith must rise, and everything that rises must converge. When he wrote this at the time that organized Marxism was, almost uniformly, explicitly Stalinist. In 1949, when the USSR was imposing communism on the East European nations, and when the crimes of the Nazis were known to all, Teilhard said that totalitarianism was one of the natural components needed for human progress anthropogenesis. But does not the strange and persistent cleavage, so invariably manifest within so-called democratic movements in the opposed concepts of liberalism and dirigisme, or individualism and totalitarianism, explain itself when we realize that, although they may look like contradictory social ideals, they are in fact natural components, personalization and totalization, whose interaction biologically determines the essence and progress of anthropogenesis. On the one hand, we have a system centered on the individual, and on the other a system centered on the group. But there is really no contradiction in this. It is simply a matter of disconnection and disharmony which may even, why not, be an inevitable and necessary alteration. Biologically, let me repeat, there can be no true democracy without the balanced combination of these two complementary factors, which in their pure state are expressed, one by individualist and the other by authoritarian regimes. Point 2 However, in May 1952, Teilhard wrote that the abatement of tension between the USSR and the US would not be possible until the Russians stop telling lies, give up their morality of deception, which is the root of the matter. 3 In The Phenomenon of Man, Teilhard spoke more harshly against communism and Nazism than he did elsewhere, but still said that modern totalitarianism is really the distortion of something magnificent, and thus quite near to the truth. The million in rank and file on the parade ground. The million standardized in the factory. The million motorized, and all this only ending up with communism and national socialism and the most ghastly fetters. So we get the crystal instead of the cell, the anthill instead of brotherhood. Instead of the upsurge of consciousness which we expected, it is mechanization that seems to emerge inevitably from totalization.
Et pour si muove.
For in the presence of such a profound perversion of the rules of noagenesis, I hold that our reaction should not be one of despair but of a determination to re-examine ourselves. When an energy runs amok, the engineer, far from questioning the power itself, simply works out his calculations afresh to see how it can be better brought under control. Monstrous as it is not modern totalitarianism really the distortion of something magnificent and thus quite near to the truth? Balancing laissez-faire with firmness. In the late 1940s, Teilhard offered the nascent UN an ambiguous perspective on human rights and individual freedom. He provided loopholes for those who would remake mankind, loopholes large enough to hold a gulag. In 1947, Teilhard told UNESCO that the purpose of a new Declaration of the Rights of Man cannot be, as formerly, to ensure the highest possible degree of independence for the individual and society, but to define the conditions under which the inevitable totalization of mankind may be effected, not only without impairing but so as to enhance, I will not say the autonomy of each of us but, a quite different thing, the incommunicable singularity of being which each of us possesses. We must no longer seek to organize the world in favor of, and in terms of, the isolated individual. We must try to combine all things for the perfection, personalization, of the individual by his well-ordered integration with the unified group in which mankind must eventually culminate, both organically and spiritually. Whatever measures may be adopted to this end, there is one major principle which must be affirmed and always upheld. In no circumstances, and for no reason, must the forces of collectivity compel the individual to deform or falsify himself by accepting as true what he sees to be false, for example, which is to lie to himself. Every limitation imposed on the autonomy of the element by the power of the group must, if it is to be justified, operate only in conformity with the free internal structure of the element. Otherwise, a fundamental disharmony will arise in the very heart of the collective human organism. Three principles, therefore. The absolute duty of the individual to develop his own personality. The relative right of the individual to be placed in circumstances as favorable as possible to his personal development. The absolute right of the individual, within the social organism, not to be deformed by external coercion but inwardly superorganized by persuasion, that is to say, in conformity with his personal endowments and aspirations. 1. Teilhard said in 1949 that there are two general conditions which must at all costs be observed in the planning of democratic institutions. The first of these is that the individual must be allowed the widest possible liberty of choice within which to develop his personal qualities, the one theoretical restriction being that his choice should be exercised in the direction of heightened powers of reflection and consciousness. The second, offsetting the first, is that everything must be done to promote and foster currents of convergence, collective organizations, within which alone, by the laws of anthropogenesis, individual action can achieve its fulfillment and full substance. In short, what is needed is a judicious mixture of laissez-faire and firmness. The problem is one of moderation, tact, and art, for which no hard and fast rules can be laid down, but which, in each particular case, any body of people is perfectly capable of solving in its own way, provided its instinct of progress and superhumanization is sufficiently developed. 2. Firmness, of course, could include imposition of Soviet-style dictatorship, and local or national self-determination on these matters might be limited to those whose instinct of progress was adequate. A pragmatic, evolutionary case for euthanasia and eugenics. Teilhard de Chardin advanced a hardline, Darwinian justification for euthanasia. In Human Energy, he said in 1937 that the strong needed to consider new ways to handle life's rejects in the hospitals. How should we judge the efforts we lavish in all kinds of hospitals on saving what is so often no more than one of life's rejects? Something profoundly true and beautiful. I mean faith in the irreplaceable value and unpredictable resources contained in each personal unit, is evidently concealed in persistent sacrifice to save a human existence. But should not this solicitude of man for his individual neighbor be balanced by a higher passion, born of the faith in that other higher personality that is to be expected, as we shall see, from the worldwide achievements of our evolution? To what extent should not the development of the strong, to the extent that we can define this quality, take precedence over the preservation of the weak? How can we reconcile, in a state of maximum efficiency, the care lavished on the wounded with the more urgent necessities of battle? 1. In what does true charity consist? 2. Did you know that each of us is a personal unit? So much for the notion that we are all created in the image of God. Teilhard's beliefs are consistent with Alice Bailey's teaching that, when a form proves inadequate, or too diseased, or too crippled for the expression of that purpose, it is, from the point of view of the hierarchy, no disaster when that form has to go. 3. In the phenomenon of man, Teilhard made the case for eugenics as a planned response to the suppression of the crude forces of natural selection among mankind. So far, we have certainly allowed our race to develop at random, and we have given too little thought to the question of what medical and moral factors must replace the crude forces of natural selection should we suppress them. In the course of the coming centuries, it is indispensable that a nobly human form of eugenics, on a standard worthy of our personalities, should be discovered and developed. Eugenics applied to individuals leads to eugenics applied to society. For likewise, in 1948, he said that after the 17th century, the Earth's population began to shoot up in an alarming fashion. Now we suddenly see the saturation point ahead of us and approaching at a dizzy speed. How are we to prevent this compression of mankind on the closed surface of the planet, a thing that is good in itself, as we have seen, since it promotes social unification, from passing that critical point beyond which any increase in numbers will mean famine and suffocation? Above all, how are we to assure that the maximum population, when it is reached, shall be composed only of elements harmonious in themselves and blended as harmoniously as possible together? Individual eugenics 5, breeding and education designed to produce only the best individual types, and racial eugenics, the grouping or intermixing of different ethnic types being not left to chance but affected as a controlled process in the proportions most beneficial to humanity as a whole, both, as I well know, come up against apparently insuperable difficulties from the point of view of technical organization and from that of psychological resistance. But this does not alter the fact that the problem of building a healthy mankind already stares us in the face and is growing more acute every day. 6. Teilhard saw the obstacles to eugenics, including racial eugenics, as technical and psychological resistance, not as moral laws forbidding such actions. Teilhard's enthusiasm for eugenics was shared among authoritarians of the right, the center, and the left during the last century. The U.S. had taken the lead in these policies. Starting in 1899, 35 states allowed the sterilization of the mentally handicapped. Michael Burley, a historian of the Third Reich, reported, "Wealthy philanthropists bore the cost of the eugenics laboratory at Cold Spring Harbor, the New York-based center of this movement, as well as for a eugenics institute in Munich under the Weimar Republic." 7. This foreshadowed the zeal for contraception and population control among present-day American billionaires and foundations. Burley continued, "German eugenicists in turn enthused over American sterilization laws and the 1924 Immigration Restriction Act. American studies of poor white trash families were effortlessly absorbed into the visual repertory of the National Socialists. One Nazi eugenics led to compulsory sterilization of the unfit, and to the mass murder of the disabled and the chronically ill." 2. Fabian socialists in Britain likewise favored eugenics. As Burley reports, in Britain, where in 1931 a Labour MP endeavored to introduce legislation permitting voluntary sterilization, the Fabian socialist Sidney Webb gave the game away about this enthusiasm when he announced, "No consistent eugenicist can be a laissez-faire individualist unless he throws up the game in despair. He must interfere, interfere, interfere." Apart from a doctrinaire credulousness towards the prophylactic powers of modern science, some illiberal socialists wished to police and reform the lifestyles of those lumpen proletarians who did not conform to their ideals of what working-class people should be. 3. In his 1928 manifesto The Open Conspiracy, the reformer H.G. Wells avowed the need for directed breeding, adding that, "The world community of our desires, the organized world community conducting and ensuring its own progress requires a deliberate collective control of population as a primary condition. For the communists also supported eugenics. Robert Proctor, a historian of medicine under the Nazis, noted that in 1931, the Communist Party of Germany expressed support for the sterilization of psychiatric patients under certain circumstances. Between 1931 and 1938, Germany and the Soviet Union shared a joint institute for racial biology established in Moscow on the initiative of the German eugenicists Ludwig Aschoff and Oscar Voigt. In 1932, the American communist leader William Z. Foster wrote that communist society will turn its attention to the subjective factor, to the fundamental improvement of man himself, and will go farther. It will scientifically regulate the growth of population. It will especially speed up the very evolution of man himself, his brain and body. Capitalism has checked the evolution of the human species if it has not actually brought about a process of race degeneration. But communism will systematically breed up mankind. Already the scientific knowledge is at hand to do this, but it is at present inapplicable because of the idiocy of the capitalist system, its planlessness, its antiquated moral codes, its warp and woof of exploitation. Darwinian racism. In a 1937 essay in Human Energy, Teilhard favored eugenics as a way for the advancing wing of humanity to deal with fixed or definitely unprogressive ethnical groups. In this field, the apostles of birth control, although too often inspired by the narrow desire of relieving individual hardships, will have rendered us the service of opening our eyes to the anomaly of a society that concerns itself with everything except the recruitment of its own elements. Now, eugenics does not confine itself to a simple control of births. All sorts of related questions, scarcely yet raised despite their urgency, are attached to it. What fundamental attitude, for example, should the advancing wing of humanity take to fixed or definitely unprogressive ethnical groups? The Earth is a closed and limited surface. To what extent should it tolerate, racially or nationally, areas of lesser activity? Teilhard made some specific guesses about who these fixed or definitely unprogressive ethnical groups might be: Chinese, Indians, and Africans, among others. He did so despite describing the doctrine of the selection and election of races as cynical and brutal theories in which, however, a noble passion may also stir subtle deformation of a great truth that would disfigure or hide from our eyes the veritable contours of the new sphere one and render biologically impossible the formation of a veritable spirit of the earth. 2. Teilhard added that the gates of the future, the entry into the superhuman, will open only to an advance of all. Together, in a direction in which altogether three can join and find completion in a spiritual renovation of the earth. For in August 1923, Teilhard wrote, "When I came to China, I hoped to find a reservoir of thought and mysticism that would bring fresh youth to our West. I now have the impression that the reservoir is blocked/emptied. The Chinese are primitive people, beneath their varnish of modernity or Confucianism. The Mongols are in gradual process of disappearance, and their lamas are coarse and dirty monks." 5. In October 1923, Teilhard wrote of his travel through Asia, "For long weeks I have been submerged in the deep flood of the people of Asia. Nowhere, among the men I met or heard about, have I discerned the smallest seed whose growth will benefit the future of mankind. Throughout my whole journey I have found nothing but absence of thought, senile thought, or infantile thought. I am a pilgrim of the future on my way back from a journey made entirely in the past." 6. In April 1927, he wrote, "In the light of the convergent evidence that I have gathered here from the most diverse men, I see an increasing possibility for another hypothesis, namely, that the Chinese are arrested primitives, victims of retarded development whose anthropological substance is inferior to ours. Neither the Christian attitude of love for all mankind, nor humane hopes for an organized society, must cause us to forget that the human stratum may not be homogeneous. If it were not, it would be necessary to find for the Chinese, as for the Negroes, their special function, which may not, by biological impossibility, be that of the whites. I do not like these prospects, but they may someday become necessary. Is not the real way to conquer the world to utilize its faults, and not to deny them, if they are irremediable. 7. In January 1929, Teilhard put the rural Somalis onto history's refuse pile. He said that the human inhabitants would make an interesting study. Moreover, unlike the Chinese, they are well worth looking at. Tingkali, Hissa, Karagon, Ergala. They all have magnificent copper-colored bodies, so that they really blend with the landscape and the fauna. It's a survival of a splendid human type, but how ill-fitted, it would seem, to follow our forward march. They will merge or disappear, like the zebras and elephants. Progress itself implies an unquenchable force that insists on the destruction of everything which has outlived its time. 8. In September 1935, Teilhard indicated that he was not able to speak against the invasion of Ethiopia by fascist Italy. He said, "In this mixed society, you hear every sort of comment, from black to white, on the Abyssinian question. And I'm annoyed within myself as I realize my difficulty in finding a good reason for adopting any particular attitude. It's clear that we must tend toward a moral and biological organization of the earth. But what should be the attitudes of human groups in relation to one another, seeing that their social values and capabilities differ so greatly? The more I see of the East, the more I distrust the demagogue in international matters." 1. As a biographer noted, in early September 1935, he set sail for India. At Eritrea, he watched with weary disinvolvement as regiments of sweating young Italians boarded troop ships bound for Ethiopia. 2. In December 1935, while traveling through India, Teilhard wrote, "There are, in fact, human groups that differ biologically and physically, and they can be converted only by first transforming them within the human plane. I believe such convergence to be possible. So far as I have been able to form an opinion of them, the Hindus have been a disappointment to me. In them, too, the creative power seems in a pretty poor way, and you have to go to India to realize the numbing and deadening effect of a religion obsessed by material forms and ritualism." 3. While traveling from Java to China in January 1936, Teilhard wrote, "As individuals, Indians are charming, but taken as a whole, the country seems to be just as incapable of self-government as China or Malaya. Unfortunately, dislike of the English is general among the natives. They want complete independence at all costs, even if it means death to the country. The more I get around the world, the more I fear that Geneva, of which I am in my heart a great supporter, numbers of liberal Catholics, and especially my colleagues the missiologues, for making a grave mistake in recognizing the equality of races in the face of all the biological evidence. Universalism is not democracy, equals egalitarianism." 5. In the same month, Teilhard expanded upon this in a letter to another friend. "The objective fact seems to me this: 1. No international morality is possible without previous acceptance that there is an earth to be constructed which transcends states. 2. And once this construction has been agreed to, everything must give way. And as not all ethnic groups have the same value, they must be dominated, which does not mean they must be despised. Quite the reverse." 6. As a comment on this, Teilhard added, "In other words, at one and the same time there should be official recognition of, 1. The priority/primacy of the earth over nations, 2. The inequality of peoples and races." Now the second point is currently reviled by communism and the church, and the first point is similarly reviled by the fascist systems, and of course, by less gifted peoples. 7. All of this had practical consequence. In a war of construction, Teilhard recognized the right of the earth to organize itself by reducing, even by force, the reactionary and backwards elements. 8. Therefore, in this sense, in last analysis, I am with Mussolini against the liberals of the left and the missiologists. 9. Thus, in the last analysis, Teilhard supported fascist aggression against an African nation, an invasion that set the stage for the Berlin-Rome Axis. In a 1948 essay, My Fundamental Vision, Teilhard proclaimed that humanity must, provided heaven grant it life, continue its advance, characterized by constantly increasing unification, centration, and spiritualization, the whole system rising unmistakably toward a critical point of final convergence. 1. He offered the preconditions for this prediction in a footnote, following the words, provided heaven grant it life. The absence of any astronomical or biological catastrophe which would destroy the earth or life on earth, a continued supply of the natural resources available in the continents, which feed man's individual and social body, and C. effective control, both in quantity and quality, of reproduction in order to avoid overpopulation of the earth or its invasion by a less satisfactory ethnic group. 2. Fertile hard. As with Blavatsky and Bailey, racism appeared to be consistent with evolutionary spirituality. However, unlike Alice Bailey, Teilhard eschewed anti-Semitism. In an August 1941 letter, he described this prejudice as odious imbecility, World War II as a crisis of birth for humanity. Like Alice Bailey, Teilhard de Chardin hailed the world wars as occasions for human unity and progress. In May 1939, Teilhard did not expect war to come. However, he said that his secret hope was that a deeper evolution towards some sound internationalism is going on in the masses so that a new world will emerge. A mass experience, and unfortunately a mass suffering, seems to be the condition for a mass transformation. For this, mass experience began in September 1939. Near the end of the war, in March 1945, Teilhard described World War II as a crisis of birth for a new humanity. Finally, the present war, a war which for the first time in history is as widespread as the earth itself, a conflict in which human masses as great as continents clash together, a catastrophe in which we seem to be swept off our feet as individuals. What aspect can it wear to our awakened eyes except that of a crisis of birth, almost disproportionately small in relation to the vastness of what it is destined to bring forth? 5. He thus anticipated the words that Barbara Marx Hubbard uses to describe humanity's current situation. In December 1945, Teilhard described World War II as this new stirring of the human dough. He held that this war, along with World War I, fostered human unity. Ethnically, during the same period, there has been a vast and pitiless confusion of peoples, whole armies being removed from one hemisphere to the other, and tens of thousands of refugees being scattered across the world like seed borne on the wind. Brutal and harsh though the circumstances have been, who can fail to perceive the inevitable consequences of this new stirring of the human dough? And economically and psychically, the entire mass of mankind, under the inexorable pressure of events and owing to the prodigious growth and speeding up of the means of communication, has found itself seized in the mold of a communal existence. Large sections tightly encased in countless international organizations, the most ambitious the world has ever known, and the whole anxiously involved in the same passionate upheavals, the same problems, the same daily news. Can anyone seriously suppose that we shall be able to rid ourselves of habits such as these? No. During these 6 years, despite the unleashing of so much hatred, the human bloc has not disintegrated. On the contrary, in its most rigid organic depths, it has increased its vice-like grip upon us all. First 1914 to 1918, then 1939 to 1945, two successive turns of the screw. Every new war, embarked upon by the nations for the purpose of detaching themselves from one another, merely results in their being bound and mingled together in a more inextricable knot. The more we seek to thrust each other away, the more do we interpenetrate. Point one, in like manner, Alice Bailey had described the dislocation of people due to war and tyranny as the institution of a process of blending for mankind. In September 1939, too, she had said, Mussolini, the regenerator of his people, Hitler, who lifted a distressed people upon his shoulders, Lenin, the idealist, Stalin and Franco are all expressions of the Shambhala force and of certain little understood energies. These have wrought significant changes in their day and generation and altered the face of Europe, incidentally affecting Asia and conditioning attitudes and policies in America. The results, even when dangerous and terrible, have developed two vital characteristics in humanity. One has been the widespread development of the discriminating faculty, and secondly, a tendency to dispersion with its consequences of diffusing civilized and cultural values and the diverse gifts of the many people to the world's soul. The drift of people to the colonies from Great Britain, the drift of the people from every nation in Europe to America, North and South, the dispersal of people within national boundaries as the result of war and expediency, such as the evacuation of cities has brought about today, the removal of people out of Italy and of groups of people within Russia, and the constant moving onwards of the wandering Jews indicate a breaking down, upon a worldwide scale, of all outer boundaries and the institution of a process of blending and amalgamation such as the world has never seen before. It constitutes an educational system of untold value. Atom bombs, heralding the coming of the spirit of the earth. Soon after the bomb fell on Hiroshima, Teilhard exulted in the heart of matter. In our recent mastery of the atomic, we have reached the primordial sources of the energy of evolution. New powers call for new aspirations. If mankind is to use its new access of physical power with balanced control, it cannot do without a rebound of intensity in its eagerness to act, to seek, to create. Foreshadowing Barbara Marx Hubbard, he said in 1946, "In exploding the atom, we took our first bite at the fruit of the great discovery, and this was enough for a taste to enter our mouths that can never be washed away. The taste for supercreativeness." 5 in September 1946, after the U.S. nuclear tests in the Pacific Ocean, Teilhard closed a paean to the bomb by saying, "The atomic age is not the age of destruction but the age of union and research." For all their military trappings, the recent explosions at Bikini herald the birth into the world of a mankind both inwardly and outwardly pacified. They proclaim the coming of the spirit of the earth. 6. Like any god, the spirit of the earth will be jealous, demanding of zeal and sacrifice, finding expression through a crisis of conversion. In a 1931 essay in Human Energy, Teilhard wrote, "To exert constant pressure on the whole area of reality, is this not the supreme sign of faith in being and therefore of worship? All this is ours if we learn not to stifle the spirit of earth in us. But let there be no mistake. He who wishes to share in this spirit must die and be reborn, to himself and to others. To reach the higher plane of humanity, he must not only reflect and see a particular situation intellectually, but also make a complete change in his fundamental way of valuation and action. In him, a new plane, individual, social, and religious, must eliminate another. This entails inner tortures and persecutions. The earth will only become conscious of itself through the crisis of conversion." 1. Teilhard's proclamation of the Spiritus Mundi foreshadowed Bishop Swing's announcement at the 1997 summit meeting of the URI that, "If you come here because a spirit of colossal energy is being born in the loins of the earth, then come here and be a midwife. Assist, in awe, at the birth of a new hope." 2. In 1937, Teilhard said that mankind might need to continue developing ever greater and more destructive weapons until the spirit of discovery absorbs the whole vital force contained in the spirit of war. "At present, the majority of men do not yet understand force, the key and symbol of greater being, except in its most primitive and savage form of war. This is perhaps why it is necessary for us to continue for some time still to manufacture ever greater and more destructive weapons. For we still, alas, need these machines to translate the vital sense of attack and victory into concrete experience. But may the moment come, and it will come, when the masses realize that the true human victories are those over the mysteries of matter and life. May the moment come when the man in the street understands that there is more poetry in a mighty machine for splitting the atom than in any artillery. A decisive hour will strike for man, when the spirit of discovery absorbs the whole vital force contained in the spirit of war. The coming separation of reactionaries and progressives." Teilhard was, for decades, a zealot for progress. In December 1923, he wrote, "I have a ferocious belief in progress of some kind, and I hold those who deny it as evildoers and heretics." For in January 1941, Teilhard said, "It seems obvious to me that the moment has come when mankind is going to be divided, or will have to make the choice, between faith and non-faith in the earth's collective spiritual progress." 5. In February 1941, Teilhard likewise said, "The world of tomorrow will be born out of the elected group of those, arising from any direction and class and confession in the human world, who will decide that there is something big waiting for us ahead, and give their life to reach it. People have to decide for or against progress now, and those who say no have just to be dropped behind. And those who say yes will soon discover that they speak the same language and even worship the same God." 6. He likewise prophesied in March 1945, "The profound cleavage in every kind of social group, families, countries, professions, creeds, which during the past century has become manifest in the form of two increasingly distinct and irreconcilable human types, those who believe in progress and those who do not. What does this portend except the separation and birth of a new stratum in the biosphere? This separation would divide the elect elements of planetization from the cast-offs who do not believe in progress. Teilhard said in December 1945, it would seem, then, that the grand phenomenon which we are now witnessing represents a new and possibly final division of mankind, based no longer on wealth but on belief in progress. The old Marxist conflict between producers and exploiters becomes outdated, at the best a misplaced approximation. What finally divides the men of today into two camps is not class but an attitude of mind, the spirit of movement. On the one hand, there are those who simply wish to make the world a comfortable dwelling place. On the other hand, those who can only conceive of it as a machine for progress, or better, an organism that is progressing. On the one hand, the bourgeois spirit in its essence, and on the other, the true toilers of the earth, those of whom we may safely predict that, without violence or hatred, simply by biological predominance, they will tomorrow constitute the human race. On one hand, the cast-offs. On the other, the agents and elements of planetization. Point one, Teilhard offered fewer specifics than Barbara Marx Hubbard about the coming division of mankind between evolutions elected and rejected, and his rhetoric was less brutal than that used by Alice Bailey. Nevertheless, all three authors have proposed the same fate for reactionaries. The age of nations has passed. Like today's New Age and globalist writers, Teilhard proclaimed the obsolescence of the nation-state. He said in 1931, too much iron, too much wheat, too many automobiles, but also too many books, too many observations, and also too many diplomas, technicians, and workmen, and even too many children. The world cannot function without productive living beings, food, ideas. But its production is more and more patently exceeding its powers of absorption and assimilation. Here again, as in the case of love, we must ask what this excess production means. Is the world condemned, as it grows, to automatic death by stifling beneath its own excessive weight? Not at all, we would answer. It is in course of gathering to itself a new and higher body. At this crisis of birth, everything depends on the prompt emergence of a soul which by merely appearing will come to organize, lighten, and vitalize this mass of stagnant and confused matter. Now this soul, if it exists, can only be the conspiration of individuals, associating to raise the edifice of life to a new stage. The resources at our disposal today, the powers that we have released, could not possibly be absorbed by the narrow system of individual or national units which the architects of the human earth have hitherto used. Our plan was to build a big house, larger but similar in design to our good old dwelling places. And now we have been led by the higher logic of progress which is in us, to collect components that are too big for the use we intended to make of them. The age of nations has passed. Now, unless we wish to perish, we must shake off our old prejudices and build the earth. Exalting planning and use of man's power. Teilhard maintained a lifelong enthusiasm for beneficent use of human power. In September 1948, he commented that a reviewer of a book by Julian Huxley criticized Huxley's warning that in the near future we shall be able to control genetically the products of human generation. Because, the reviewer says, it is impossible or dangerous to decide what should be the best human type. A very stupid criticism, probably expressing some anti-communist feeling, underestimating the fact that if man really succeeds in controlling his own heredity, no force in the world will prevent him from using his new power. I recognize that planning is always dangerous. But the question is not there. The question is to decide whether man can avoid being forced to plan by the very process of cosmic evolution. And the answer is that he cannot, because planning is the essence of life. Point one, comprehensive planning is to be applied worldwide. In the phenomenon of man, Teilhard said, if there is a future for mankind, it can only be imagined in terms of a harmonious conciliation of what is free with what is planned and totalized. Points involved are the distribution of the resources of the globe, the control of the trek towards unpopulated areas, the optimum use of the powers set free by mechanization, the physiology of nations and races, geoeconomy, geopolitics, geodemography, the organization of research developing into a reasoned organization of the Earth. Whether we like it or not, all the signs and all our needs converge in the same direction. Point two, not even the horrors of the Third Reich's concentration camps could shake Teilhard's faith in human progress. A friendly biographer noted, to some of his adversaries, Teilhard's optimistic viewpoint seemed more than a little naive. Once in a debate with Gabriel Marcel on the subject of science and rationality, he shocked his opponent by refusing to permit even the appalling evidence of the experiments of the doctors of Dachau to modify his faith in the inevitability of human progress. Man, he asserted, to become fully man, must have tried everything. Of course, he added as a corollary, since the human species was still so young and still prone to fall back into the dark from which it came, the persistence of such evil was to be expected. But since, unlike the lower animals, man no longer acted purely out of instinct, he would presumably abandon every new experiment the moment he saw it did not lead him to greater personalization. Prometheus, Marcel had cried, articulating the astonishment of most of the audience. No, Teilhard replied, only man as God has made him. Evolutionary utopia, war in a naturally sublimated form. Teilhard's view of the ideal human society was not one of peace and ordered liberty. It was instead a vision of an ongoing evolutionary struggle, war in a naturally sublimated form. He said, all hope of bourgeois tranquility, the dreams of millenary felicity in which we may be tempted to indulge, must be washed out, eliminated from our horizon. A perfectly ordered society with everyone living in effortless ease within a fixed framework, a world in a state of tranquil repose, all this has nothing to do with our advancing universe, apart from the fact that it would rapidly induce a state of deadly tedium. Although, as I believe, concord must of necessity prevail on Earth, it can by our premises only take the form of some sort of tense cohesion pervaded and inspired with the same energies, now become harmonious, which were previously wasted in bloodshed. Unanimity in search and conquest, sustained among us by the universal resolve to raise ourselves upwards, all straining shoulder to shoulder, towards ever greater heights of consciousness and freedom. In short, true peace, the only kind that is biologically possible, betokens neither the ending nor the reverse of warfare, but war in a naturally sublimated form. It reflects and corresponds to the normal state of mankind become at last alive to the possibilities and demands of its evolution. Point 4. C.S. Lewis spoke against such a cruel and utopian view of the purpose of politics and human institutions. In Mere Christianity, he said, the state exists simply to promote and to protect the ordinary happiness of human beings in this life. A husband and wife chatting over a fire, a couple of friends having a game of darts in a pub, a man reading a book in his own room or digging in his own garden. That is what the state is there for. And unless they are helping to increase and prolong and protect such moments, all the laws, parliaments, armies, courts, police, economics, etc., are simply a waste of time. The Vatican's 1962 warning against Teilhard's works. During his lifetime, Friar Teilhard de Chardin was prohibited by his religious superiors from publishing his works. He obeyed, but continued to write. After his death in 1955, Teilhard's works began to be published and attained wide popularity. In response, in 1962, the Vatican's Holy Office, the predecessor of the current Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, issued a monitum, an official warning against his writings. Several works of Father Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, some of which were posthumously published, are being edited and are gaining a good deal of success. Prescinding from a judgment about those points that concern the positive sciences, it is sufficiently clear that the above-mentioned works abound in such ambiguities and indeed even serious errors as to offend Catholic doctrine. For this reason, the most eminent and most revered fathers of the Holy Office exhort all ordinaries as well as the superiors of religious institutes, rectors of seminaries and presidents of universities, effectively to protect the minds, particularly of the youth, against the dangers presented by the works of Friar Teilhard de Chardin and of his followers. Point 2. In July 1981, the Holy See reiterated the concerns that it had raised in the 1962 warning. Point 3. Thus, the Vatican's doctrinal watchdogs under two popes, John XII and John Paul II, held the line against Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. Given the nature of Teilhard's teachings, these warnings seem amply justified. A present-day Vatican compromise with Teilhard? In this context, it is disconcerting that the just-mentioned Holy Office document was, as of mid-2004, online at a conservative American Roman Catholic website. It was not found at the official Vatican website. Teilhard's followers claim that he is being rehabilitated by the Catholic Church. The British Teilhard Association's online biography of Teilhard states that shortly after the 1962 warning from the Holy Office, the Jesuit General Jean-Baptiste Janssens authorized Teilhard's friend and confrere, the theologian, and later cardinal, Henri de Lubac, to publish a defense of Teilhard, La pensée religieuse du père Teilhard de Chardin, 1962, published with imprimatur, saying it would be quite wrong to attach any value to an anonymous article. Pope John XII later described the incident of the Monatum as most regrettable. Both decree and Monatum have long since been forgotten by all but Teilhard's bitterest opponents who, in the words of theologian Bruno de Saliges, quite simply cannot not see beyond their noses. The process of rehabilitation that had begun immediately after his death gathered pace on the centenary of his birth in 1981 with an important seminar on Teilhard at the Catholic Institute of Paris. In a letter to the rector of the Institute written on behalf of Pope John Paul II, Cardinal Casaroli spoke warmly of Teilhard's powerful poetic insight into the deep value of nature, his constant desire for dialogue with science, and, above all, his concern to honor both faith and reason. And Pedro Arup S.J., General of the Society of Jesus, wrote to the Provincial of France, Teilhard's ideas proclaim the openness and concern with cultivating the world which characterize the teachings of the Council and of John XII and Paul VI and, today, John Paul II. On January 5, 1983, Henri de Lubac was created cardinal. John Paul II honored de Lubac in his own right, but he also honored, in a very real sense, Teilhard in the person of de Lubac, who had been his great defender. And this was developed even further in 1995 on the 40th anniversary of Teilhard's death in letters from Peter Hans Kalvenbach S.J. on behalf of the Jesuits and from Timothy Radcliffe Opie on behalf of the Dominicans. 1A collection of letters from Teilhard to one of his friends earned a nihil obstat and an imprimatur. A declaration that a book or pamphlet is considered to be free from doctrinal or moral error. In 1968 from the Catholic Archdiocese of Westminster, in England. 2. This was so, even though in this collection of letters, Teilhard had said, at one and the same time there should be official recognition of, 1. The priority/primacy of the earth over nations, 2. The inequality of peoples and races. Now the second point is currently reviled by communism and the church, and the first point is similarly reviled by the fascist systems. 3. Additionally, amid 2004 search of the Vatican's homepage, using the Vatican-provided search engine, revealed no English-language documents specifically criticizing Teilhard de Chardin's work, and 3 such documents with brief, favorable mention of him. Can it be that the Vatican is gradually evolving, making a turn toward accepting the wayward Jesuits' theories, including the totalization of humanity? In late 2001, Archbishop Agostino Marcetto, newly appointed by Pope John Paul II as the Secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant People, wrote, I will ask a mystic, the Jesuit Father Teilhard de Chardin, to be our teacher for a deeper knowledge of the Word, the Son of God. Here is the text that I have chosen for you. He then quoted Teilhard's La Messe sur le Monde as his Christmas greeting to readers of the Pontifical Council's newsletter. Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant People, new secretary at the Pontifical Council, Apostolatus Maris. The Church in the Maritime World, number 75, 2001/4, http://www.vatican.va/roman_curia/pontifical_councils_migrants/sfx/affairs/stellamartellitus/75pdf, printed July 30, 04, p2. In a document posted at the Vatican website by the Pontifical Council for Culture, an American Jesuit wrote, it is important that Catholics show respect for modern science. As an anthropologist, I am especially aware of this need in regard to evolution. Generally, we have a good record on this, Teilhard de Chardin, etc., but the public has to be reminded of it. William Biernatsky, S.J., Tendencies Within U.S. Culture, Plenaria 97, http://www.vatican.va/roman_curia/pontifical_councils/cultar/documents/rcnr.
PC-031-1995-I-1995-PLE-AN. HTML, Section 3, Print 07-30-04.
In a document posted on the Vatican website by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, Paul Cardinal Popard praised Teilhard's science and Christ as a very noteworthy attempt in the direction of a scientific Christology. It was a noble effort on the part of one of the 20th century's great anthropologists to bring his scientific knowledge face to face with Christ. In his study of matter, this great Jesuit anthropologist perceived a strong urge to unification and synthesis, an excess of energy which enabled matter to transcend itself more and more. He saw this as evidence of a process which would culminate in Christ. Teilhard was obviously not so naive as to try to deduce Christian doctrine from the simple study of the properties of matter. He wrote that science, left to itself, cannot discover Christ, but Christ fulfills the desires which arise in our hearts when we are at the school of science. For Teilhard, Christ was so much a part of nature as a unifying element that he did not always acknowledge Christ's individuality. But at least he was looking in the right direction in his attempt to build a bridge between scientific research and the person of Christ. Paul Cardinal Popard, Christ and Science.